get tired. Always inspired. Totally Wired Radio.
Welcome to the Modcast with Eddie Piller and friends. Tuck in your dicky, straighten your peckham, and let's begin.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to the second Q&A this weekend, covered by Richard Searle, because Ed, as we know, is a little bit poorly, but he's very gutted to be missing it, and I'm in touch with him constantly. He's just a little bit tired, but he'll be back next year. So we have Richard Searle talking to Mick Talbot, as we know, from the Style Council, and there'll be a Q&A, and he'll be signing some books afterwards and some records. So without further ado, here is Richard and Mick. And obviously stick around for the after, we've got loads of DJs. Thank you for coming.
Hello again. So thank you for the second of the Modcast Q&A sessions. If you weren't here yesterday, I'm Richard Searle from Corduroy, the Welsh Suspect Radio Show, and Doctor and Medics, but we don't like to mention that. Our guest today, one of the most in-demand session musicians of our generation, the talented half of the Style Council, Mick Talbot.
Hello. Testing, 1, 2.
So possibly my first and most important question of this hour, is it possible, in your opinion, to have thrills without the aid of wheels?
Well, I see what you've done there. You quoted an old scripture. Well, I didn't think so back then, but possibly it is now.
You've changed your position
on
this.
Well, now I've got my 60-plus oyster. I've got a different opinion on that.
Okay. Do you think you should make a musical statement of that fact?
I think we could do a retread and just, say about...
You don't need wheels if you want to have thrills.
Well, just examine how public transport has actually improved.
I think you're a comedian now. Okay, well, I'll talk about the Merton Parks for a bit if I can.
Uh-huh.
So you're in the band with your brother.
Yep.
Were you like a musical family? Would you like trained? Do you have piano lessons? Or did punk rock happen and you decided, okay, we'll learn 3 chords and form a band?
Sort of both and neither, really. I did have an interest in playing the piano because we grew up with my nan. She lived with us and she played the piano by ear. And
must be tricky doing that.
Yeah, it is. But if you don't wear clip-on earrings, it's easier, yeah. I think. But that had a sort of magic to me because I just thought, how do you do it? And she said, I can't tell you. It's just an instinct. But she showed me some things, so I got interested in that. I used to like sitting, listening to her play. But she said, there's only so much I can show you. So she did send me to lessons, and I was really fearful of that. It had a kind of a negative connotation to me.
So have you got a grade on piano?
So, yeah, I went and did piano lessons.
What level did you get to?
What level?
Yeah.
Well, the seat was a bit low, and I got a few cushions on it. I did take some exams, and I got the grade 5.
Okay, so you know your scales.
Well, I did then. I couldn't actually, prepare a fish for you now.
At what point then did you form the band with your brother?
I kind of stuck with that for about 3.5 years, but I wasn't that diligent. I was really into playing football. I didn't practice enough. I sort of crammed when I had to do these grades, and in hindsight, it benefited me more than I thought it did at the time. But I couldn't wait to apply what I'd learned to music that appealed to me, which wasn't what the piano teacher was teaching,
yeah.
Which wasn't, you know. So the real keys to the universe for me were finding out that blues and rock and roll were only 3 chords, and you find out what key it's in, and you can play along to pretty much any of it. So I think I had a K-Tel Rock and Rolling Greats compilation, and I started playing along with a lot of that, you know. And uh-huh. And I kind of think part of that, the appeal of that was, it was a bit like the roots of the Beatles. You know, they name-checked the Everly Brothers and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, and all of those are on that compilation. And you think, all right, this is the DNA of what I want to get to.
Were you in other bands before you formed, the Sneakers, was it? Before the
Yeah, Mobile? I was in quite a few bands before then. Yeah,
what
I was
kind
in
of stuff?
I was in a band with some older guys at school when... I don't know, when they're 16 and you're 14 and a half or something, that's a big gap. Mm. They sort of seemed like men,
yeah.
You know, and they were doing things that I wasn't doing.
Or shaving.
Yeah, well, no, if that was only what they were doing. no. There was, you know.
So what, you're playing kind of blues
colours? They had a different shopping list when they went to the confectionery counter, if you know what I mean. So they were doing things and I saw things and, you know, it opened my eyes to a lot of things.
So what, you're learning standards, basically?
Well, not really. I mean, I think, you know, when you're in a school band, it quite often can be about compromise. You know, I might have liked a Stevie Wonder number and the person I formed a band with might like Black Sabbath, and we might be trying to make a noise somewhere in the middle of those two.
That sounds like a good band to me. So at which point then did you... Well, so let's talk about the sneakers, because pretty much that's the first thing that pops up when you researched Merton Parkers.
Well, yeah, it's the first thing that actually got any attention. I think when we were still called that, we did merit two lines as a support at the Marquee in Sounds or something, which was such a big deal to us then.
Yeah, were you like a new wave band, or were you at this point, did you say, we are a mod revival thing?
I think that we were quite moddy, but I don't know if the mod thing had took off then, just prior to that. You know, these are all sort of like press sort of labels in a way. There was a sort of power pop thing, weren't there? And I don't know when that was.
Well, that was with the Moondog Matinee. they coined power pop.
Yeah, well, I understood that Pete Townsend used that as a description quite early on as well. So maybe it was like running concurrently. But power pop always seemed to mean a different thing in America to what it meant in Britain to me. It seemed less derogatory in America than it was. I think it was a bit snarky the way the press called certain things power pop or whatever. But however, I think, you know, we were into rhythm and blues and we did a lot of covers. And so it was always not a million miles away from a sort of strong 60s influence. And I think, you know, those sort of bands appealed to us. And I can remember watching Ready, Steady, Go as a kid and thinking, right, so now I'm playing the piano. So then you're drawn towards bands that have got keyboards in. So you know, focus on Spencer Davis or Small Faces or whatever, or Manfred Mann. So
when you changed your name to the Merton Parkers, as a very specific thing you've done there, part of a mod revival movement, you put Parker in your title. Ignore us, we are mod revivalists.
Well, our thing was, our backs were up against the wall as such, because it was essentially the same band as Sneakers, but we were offered a record deal and our old management tried to steam in and get a bit legal with us about stuff. And it was getting a bit messy. We didn't have a great deal of dough. And these people were getting a bit heavy about staking a claim on us. And we disassociated ourselves with them. And the simplest way, Beggars Banquet, the independent record label we went with, was for us to say, we're disbanding the Sneakers, which you think you've got a legal agreement with.
Yeah.
And we'll become something else.
So
that was a way out, in a way, and we didn't have much time to think about it either.
Okay.
So it's like, it's not as sort of, I don't know if people found that calculated or what, but it was just like, it was a means to an end to just sort of like think, oh God. You were
one of the few bands on that mod revival thing, if you don't mind me calling you a mod revival band, where you pinned yourself down to that scene simply for having the word Parker. I know it's Merton Park, but apart from the band The Mods, there wasn't anyone else trying to tie themselves down.
I mean, it was just a humorous sort of thing. But, I mean, whether or not it sort of humoured everyone, I don't know. But it was just, there weren't a lot of time to think about it. And we just thought, yeah, why not?
You okay, know. But you didn't do the Mod Mayday album, for instance, which was specifically
a
mod.
Well, we did, but our label stopped our stuff being used.
Okay, why did they do that?
Because we were just on the threshold of delivering our first single, and they didn't want to do it. I mean, we were under a contract. We did that gig a little while before we signed it. In the interim period, we'd signed a contract, and I think a later date, what we did came out on a re-release thing, but at the time we didn't. But we were there on the day.
Did you mind not being on the release?
I don't think it would have done us any harm being on it. I think it might have shown a slightly... maybe even the better side of us in a live scenario. I mean, I think we never really made records that sort of sounded like we did live, and I think that might have represented us a bit better, you know what I mean? But it's not, you know, a deep sort of thing that I think about a lot.
But you should think about it more.
No,
you were discovered, I hear, by it was a punk journalist who introduced you to
Alan Anger.
Mm. So were you quite a gnarly band live?
I don't really know. I mean, him and, what's his friend who was the photographer on the first Jam single, did the live shots.
Who did that? Who knows?
Walt Davidson, I think his name was. He did the live shots that were taken, I think they're from the Red Cow, or maybe the Nashville. But he found us, first of all, and he said, I've got a friend who's a journalist. He's got a fanzine, but he sometimes does a few bits for Zigzag, if you remember that magazine.
Uh-huh.
And he took an interest in us, and he knew the people at Beggar's Banquet, I think.
Okay, cool.
So he was who had the Lurkers, if you remember that band.
Yes.
And he was mates with that lot. So their management started coming to watch our live gigs, and they just made us an offer. You know.
So there was a time when labels were chasing around for mod revival bands.
I suppose so. Yeah.
So was it an easy decision for Beggar's Banquet? Were they after a mod revival band at that point?
I don't know if they were specifically chasing that.
Was it a good deal?
They were just told by someone they respected that we were a good live band and go and see them. So whether or not they had one eye on that, they may have done. But
so you charted with You Need Wheels?
Yeah.
Number 40?
Yeah. Straight in, straight out.
Yeah. And the album, Facing the Crowd, is it?
Yeah.
But how did that do? Did that chart?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not being evasive or modest.
This is something which musicians, I've had experience with this myself. You walk out the studio having recorded an album and then you actually, well, I don't really like this. Do you still stand by that record you made, The Face in the Crowd album? Did you listen to it?
I don't know. No, I don't listen to it and I'm not sure.
Did you like it at the time?
I stand by it.
Did it represent you?
Probably not, no. No, it's kind of, by the time we sussed that there was a better way of making records, the band was more or less splitting up. It's just like, I think we were just probably a little bit naive and too polite to question what was happening. And I think that we naively thought, oh, we can play live, people like us live, we'll just go in and do that. And we didn't have a proper producer, we sort of self-produced it. I don't know what the credits read, but that's kind of what we did. But you're in the lap of the gods with whatever engineer you're just attached to. And it may have been a money-saving exercise for the record label to just think, oh, well, you know, they seem happy enough.
Okay. Did you get dropped, do you mind me asking, or did like an album option end and you just split?
I think we got dropped. I think they released their last single. But it all pretty, you know, it folded fairly quickly. I mean, it was done and dusted in less than a year.
But within that time, I think I told you this one time when I was pressed down the front of the moat at the Rainbow.
Right.
The Jam, Setting Suns tour. Right. They introduced Mick Talbot, who's going to play on Heatwave.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I've had this argument about you. I swear blind, you was wearing a black plastic Mac. You said you'd never owned a black plastic Mac in your life.
No. You're confusing me with Jim, their Scottish keyboard player. And he wore a wet look black plastic Mac in homage, I think that's a French word, to Ian McLagan. And there's a clip of the Small Faces on a live thing where he's wearing something very similar. And I think Paul made Jim wear that Mac.
Okay.
So I'll that let you is, off. I think his name was Jim Telford. And he was on the same label as the Jam. And I think he was in a Scottish band called Seven or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some of those facts could be wrong.
I believe you.
But that's it.
So you made the connection with the Jam, with
Weller. These are the facts,
Max. You had Rick Buckler, God bless him. He played with you at Ronnie Scott's, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. We did upstairs at Ronnie's, because that's where they put
it. So what happened to your drummer, Simon, then, if Rick Buckler's playing?
I don't know. We just knew that Rick was in the house, and he said he enjoyed the show, and he just went, get up and said, do you want to get up and do an encore with us? And he just went, well, what do I do? Play a tambourine? And went, I think Simon just sort of thought, oh, this is, you know, rock and roll royalty to us. So he said, you know, jump on the kit if you want. He said, I don't mind, you know, and so he did.
So Simon played the tambourine and Rick Buckler drum.
Well, I don't know what Simon did.
He joined Mood 6, that's what he did.
He just went, he went all psychedelic on us.
Okay, so you're friends with Paul Weller at this point?
Well, I got to know him, yeah. I mean, there was some talk in the early days that he might even produce us. But the thing is, I don't think he'd seen us live, but I believe Rick and Bruce had seen us on separate occasions. Mm-hmm. So he was aware of us.
Did you ever support the Jam?
No, we didn't, but nothing ever came of that. But he did get a copy of our single, and fortunately for me, he played the B-side. So that's my sort of... A 20-minute solo on the B-side on electric piano is just the only thing that he liked about the whole thing. But that was quite good, because he just said, I like what you're doing there, come and do some of that on Setting Suns. So that was sort of my inroad to, knowing Paul and working with him.
Okay. Is it true? It's a theory that I have.
Flat Earth Society.
When Shopping appeared on the B-side of Beach Surrender, did you already know that you was going to be doing some kind of project with Paul Weller?
No. I think
my theory is wrong.
Well, I knew at some point, but I think that had already come out before I knew.
Okay.
But I do actually think that EP is quite a good signpost of where Paul wanted to go, because Shopping's a sort of jazz waltz. There's the cover of Stoned Out of My Mind.
Yeah.
So you're getting a few of the threads that may crop up
so
again.
So at which point did the moment happen where you were approached
Let's Form a Band? The end of summer, late autumn. Late August, I think he said, meet me in the West End. I've got a project I want to put to you. And I thought he might be producing someone and just wanted me to play on it, you know. But then he just said, oh, I've got this concept. And then it was, Secret Squirrel, keep it under your hat. I'm going to wrap up the Jam and I'm going to try and do this, that, and the other. And are you up for it, And well, of course I was,
Yeah.
And, That was a really great meeting, because it was supposed to be just an hour, but it went on for about 5 hours. And but it's just great that, other than music, that's when we really checked out each other's sort of roots with books and plays and films and stuff. And all the stuff and the ephemera and the stuff that you put away that in subsequent years ended up on our favourite shop.
Yes.
A lot of that sort of stuff we were talking about is sort of represented visually on that.
Yes.
Albeit 2.5 years later. But in that initial conversation, you're touching base on all these things, Colin McGuinness, Generation X, the book, not the band. And, Neil Dunn and film noir and the new wave of French cinema and all sorts of things that have influenced you other than music. So that was really nice, and it was almost like playing chess with each other, Have you got Absolute Beginners? Yeah, but I've got City of Spades as well, and you've got to read all three of them you've really got to get deep.
Conversation...
Do you like the adaptions of Neil Dunn's thing? Which version of Up the Junction do you like? Have you got the soundtrack by Manfred Mann? Have you got... Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I do, actually. So the conversation was how many months before the split was announced?
Oh, well, I suppose 3.5, something like that. Okay. They split, was it late November?
When did they split? Do we know?
December. So, I don't know. September.
Okay, so when did you start recording? How did you come across the name, actually? Who came up with the name, Style Council?
I think it was because we, like Chairman of the Board, and a lot of Invictus stuff influenced our early things, and we wanted something that we felt was similar to that. So there was a bit of sort of brainstorming, and there was a few different things. It was nearly the Talk Society for a while, just touching on some of the Northern influence and that, but we settled with the Style Council.
When did you start recording?
I started going in and hearing a lot of demos from Paul just before the end of the year, so December. And I may have put some bits and pieces on a couple of the demos just before Christmas, but pretty much New Year we were full on. I mean, we did like a kind of session where we kind of got the first three singles out of one day with Zeke Manuka. We recorded Speak Like a Child, Money Go Round, and Solid Bond in Your Heart.
Where did Longhorn Summer
all in the same session? I mean, they kind of didn't come out.
Okay, let's talk about those early singles. So, Speak Like a Child, it kind of sounds a little bit absolute beginners-y. It's in that kind of template, I guess. Then you had Money Go Round with slap bass. Then you had Long Hot Summer with synth bass. It's like you destroyed the jam template within the first three records. Was that deliberate? We are something else entirely. Well, you follow us or you leave us.
It's all driven by the song, really. It wasn't deliberate. It's just like we must avoid conventional bass guitar at all costs, or bass guitar that sounds like the band before at all costs. It's just what drove the music, you know. Long Summer, I am the bass player on that.
Yeah.
It was just influenced by a lot of what was current at the time, really. And
slap bass, good or bad?
Depends, you know.
There's only one answer to this. It's either yes or no.
If it's Larry Graham, it's good.
Okay, I'll let you off with that. The video on Long Hot Summer, what was you doing there? What was you thinking of?
What was my motivation?
Who's that? How did you come up with that
Getting
video?
Getting paid that week.
Was it your idea? Was it pitched to you, or did you just like get a camera?
It wasn't pre-prepared, if you're talking about what I think you're talking about, but I don't know. I think that Tim Pope, the video director, said, I want a close headshot of the two of you on the picnic, gingham thing. And he just went, oh, no, you need to get closer and closer and closer. And just me and Paul were just cracking up laughing, just going, well, this looks a bit funny. And he just sort of started stroking my ear or something. And Tim kept the camera running. It wasn't scripted or planned. And it wasn't, you know, in recent times I've been asked, you just did that because to show solidarity with the, gay community. And he said, no. Not that I've got any problem with the gay community, but it was just so sort of innocuous. And then, you know, Tim showed us the rushes, and he just went, it just cracked him up so much. He went, do you mind? I'll take it off out if you want. He went, no, it's funny. It's funny, you
well,
know.
It is. Speaking of having fun, and you mentioned Solid Bond, this is a question, actually, Jason Richardson, wherever he is, to me, a pizza. He wanted to know this. In the Solid Bond video, which does look like you're having a right good laugh, how do you chop a scooter without smashing the side in? Is there like a mattress under there, or is it knackered old panels?
No, there wasn't a mattress there, and it did damage the Mark I Cortina, yeah.
Whose machines were these?
They were just hired, you know, they're just... if you've got a film set in a bygone era, there's people with classic vehicles that will rent them out.
And I don't mind you smashing them.
Well, I think there was a little bit of... There was a bit of concern, and we thought we won't be doing many more takes. Uh-huh. But in the video, it makes it something else in itself. But it wasn't planned, and it wasn't a stunt. It was, I think, Paul lost control of his vehicle.
Is that what the insurance were told?
And he failed to make an emergency stop.
It's a great video. Who pitched that video? Is that, again, you came up with
that? That was our idea. I think that's just... Paul and I, just how we aspired to be when we were little peanuts in 1970 or whenever.
Yeah.
And so they would have been the two principal characters, and that would have been people that we looked up to. So we're trying to emulate that sort of era and dress sense.
Yep.
So it was a bit of a nostalgia thing and just living out a fantasy, really, you know.
Another theory, which I have.
Oh,
the first one you've trashed. My second theory is ever-changing moods with the sleeve, with the beanie and the falconets of Gaulois smoke.
Uh-huh.
Was this a subliminal message? This is where we're going. It's a beat scene, baby, and our album, shortly to come out, is going to be heavily jazz influenced. You've destroyed the jam template.
We're telling them visually.
You're giving them the subliminal message. This is where we're going. Café Blur is not.
No, I don't know, but
like
I think, you know, prior to that single you're talking about,
yep.
I think the best indication was the EP that was Our Paris.
Paris Match.
Well, I mean, there's four tracks on that album. Officially, it's an EP called A Paris.
Right.
Which I mean, I think it means in Paris.
I can't read French.
But, so you've got Laurent Summer, you've got Paris Match, which is sort of, I don't know, what would you call that? I don't know. But it's got a few sort of interesting changes, chordally, and it's a bit of a chanson thing as well. And then there's a couple of instrumentals
that are
coming from a different angle. One's a sort of jazz waltz thing, and the other one's a little bit more plaintive and possibly influenced by the romantics, like Debussy and Ravel or whatever. Or more importantly, Michel Legrand, if we're talking about French soundtracks. So I think that is a very good signpost of four strands that were gone into more deeply with Café Blur.
So it just happened naturally. This is the direction we're going. You weren't trying to look for little signals.
No, I think it just represented what we were listening to.
And you just trashed my other theory.
Well, I'm not here to shoot you down in flames, but I'm just trying to be honest.
So Café Blur, heavily instrumental album. It was this. Mick Talbot is as much of this band as Paul Weller is of this band.
I don't know if it was about that, really. It's just that they're the tracks that come together, and it was a chance with an album. We loved the fact that we didn't pressure ourselves to make that album, and we got five singles away before we even put it out.
Mm.
And I think we were a pretty strong singles band, and we wanted to keep the singles as standalone tracks as well and not put them on the album, which we could have done. And, you know, Polydor was screaming out for us to do.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we decided to not do that, which was good, I think. And so in the long form, we wanted to try out some things that we wouldn't do before. It wasn't a case of needing to feature me, but at the same time, you know, Paul's featuring other vocalists.
Yes.
Even outside of the instrumental thing, you know, I love the Tracy Thorn version of Paris Match. It's got a completely different character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mark of what a great song that is, I think. And it's not that I've got a problem with the original. It's just it became something else.
How heavily are you involved in the writing at this point?
Not particularly heavily at all. I mean, Paul was very open to arrangement ideas and stuff, but he was a fountain of production. He wrote loads of things. I mean, you know, there's a few of the instrumental things that I wrote, and that was just a natural thing because what's that thing you keep banging out? Do you know what I mean? And sometimes they were kind of fairly spontaneous. I mean, Mick's Blessing is something that gets used quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it was such a throwaway idea. It was just like some warm-up piece, you know, and just like, let's put that at the front like it's a film. So opening titles, just an instrumental. And sort of presenting music in a kind of, I don't know, a little bit pretentious, but that was always a bit of us. In a sort of theatrical or filmic way, you know. In the same way that we like to have a rotating cast on that first album and the early singles, sort of thinking of ourselves as sort of film directors casting for the song and trying to put the song first above our own ego so you don't get into that thing where, like, why isn't the organ a bit louder? Oh, yeah. What do you play then, Mick? Organ. It's just like, what's best for the song?
Well, the keyboards are very loud on everything.
No, but there's lots of things where I'm not on. There's tracks that Paul's not on. There's tracks that I'm not on. So okay. We're sort of directing at that point.
There's the overall sound of the record. I'm coming back to this. How do you reflect upon records you put out? Were you happy with how it sounded at the time? Are you still happy with how it sounds?
Yeah, I think I was pleased with it, yeah.
Uh-huh. If you're referencing some old stuff, it doesn't sound like an old record. It sounded very contemporary.
Yeah, well, I don't think we were slavishly trying to sound like, you know, say a Blue Note record or, you know, a Stax record or whatever. But it was quite obvious we were influenced by them things. But we weren't into that thing of, like, being willfully retro. If that was part and parcel of what we were doing, that's fine.
Mm.
But we tried to mix, you know, the classic with the current. And I think possibly, like, Long Hot Summer's a good example of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's only three of us on that, me, Paul, and Steve White. It's a drum machine, but he's doing some live sort of hi-hats and bongos. Me and Paul doing all the block harmonies. So it's just a small, contained thing. I'm playing like a classic sort of Wurlitzer and organ, but at the same time, we're doing the lead on quite contemporary analog synths and the bass is on an analog synth.
Paul liked to use those arias quite a lot, didn't he?
Yeah, well,
I thought it was the sound of that.
What was it? The Herb something model. Yeah, he liked his semi-acoustic.
Yeah, I thought some of the sounds which didn't sound old, I thought was simply because the guitars he liked to use. But it's not. It's actually a deliberate choice of the mixing and the recording.
I don't know. I just, you know what? Sometimes these things are not so deeply considered. I just think you represent the song as best you can. You hope that it's achieved what you want. But sometimes you go somewhere you're not expecting, and that could be a little bit irritating, and sometimes it can be really enlightening, you know. So I think we kept an open mind with it, and you know, I'm not trying to fool myself that dropping bombs on the White House sounds like sort of Blue Note Jazz. It's certainly influenced by it, but it's quite punky in its sort of attitude, really.
So you've made a record which sounds nothing like The Jam, lots of instrumentals. Now, for me, when The Jam split up, the worst thing about that was I'd have to endure Bruce Foxton's solo records, which I never really loved. For some people, they might not have followed the line of what that Jam was through to the Style Council, and now we've got a jazz-inspired record. Was you getting any kind of friction from some of the old jam
fans? Yeah, I think there's a lot of people didn't like it, but at the same time, you picked up a lot of new people. Suddenly, we were sort of accepted by soul boys that wouldn't cross the road for the Jam. And there seemed to be a lot more girls at gigs. And Paul's really noticed that when we started playing live. Because, you know, like it or loathe it, the Jam were a bit of a boys' night out band, sort of.
Yes.
Thing. And not that we weren't, but it just seemed like there were more women or females or whatever we're supposed to call them now in the audience, as they were known then, of course. Context is everything.
So then you went...
Please don't cancel me.
you mentioned my favourite shop, so you've gone to a little bit more...
Our favourite shop.
Our favourite
not
shop.
Not yours.
A bit more poppy sounding, a bit more accessible. Was that a deliberate thing?
I think that is the most accessible album we made. And some of that's to do with the fact that we'd actually played live by then, because we didn't do many live dates until the second year of our inception. So by that time, we'd kind of worked out our strengths and weaknesses a bit. I mean, you know, Café Bleu, some people can call it brave, some people can call it foolish. I still look upon it quite fondly.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, we took sort of risks in a way, or just aimed a bit high, you know, or just went down paths that weren't really suited to us. But I think by the time we got that second album, we were more aware of our strengths.
Yeah.
And that reflects in how it comes across. And it's a bit more conventional in a way.
Yes. You must have felt very confident at this point. If you've established the band, you're doing whatever you like, pretty much musically, stylistically.
Yeah, well, it was a nice time. I mean, it's just like nothing was sort of thought out in a calculated fashion to sort of say this will be commercial, but it seemed like we were taking the hardcore of a crowd with us, and they accepted places we went, and it wasn't always that way. It's a game of two halves, really.
So I hear.
The Style Council, as well as Association
Before
Football.
Before the second half, you went to America. You charted in the Billboard charts with Ever Changing Moods, correct?
Yes.
Which The Jam never did. I don't think Paul did on this solo stuff.
Oh, right, okay.
That's so how does that feel?
Well,
that must be
that
the
was
people
quite that good. I mean, I think my Ever-Changing Moods, the company out there said they wanted that to be like a warm-up single, and they thought Best Thing would do better, but it didn't.
Uh-huh.
But Ever-Changing Moods did better than they expected, I think. But there was some talk of trying to keep Paul's picture off the sleeve because they were getting a lot of play on black stations.
Right.
Which is a bit... Well, you know, that's the way it was. It's just really weird. They just went, you know, in the States nearly 40 years ago, we got this guy with a spiky crop. He's new wave, you know. We, we're getting action on urban stations. We can't, you know, it's like, oh, Jesus.
How did you find playing in the States? Was it fun?
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, we didn't do a great deal there, but the people that came liked it, and we had some good times there. But the thing is, we had established quite a good market in Europe and Japan. America wasn't really, we weren't that successful, but I think we were signed with Geffen by then, that label.
Cool.
And they really wanted us to spend a long, long time over there. And it was just like, you know, one of them things where you think, hang on, we're turning our back on proven markets like Europe and Japan. Mm. And you almost want us to put them on hold for a year or 18 months just to come and sort of spend 9 months a year in the States to break it. And that's the way it was. And we weren't really, I mean, that was the world of sort of like lots of rock bands who just took 2 months off to turn around another album. And but we didn't fancy that.
I've got a quote.
Oh, okay. All right.
As soon as you mentioned rock bands.
Okay.
Paul Weller of Mick Talbot. He shares my hatred of the rock myth and rock culture. This is Paul Weller from the rock band The Jam, inspired by rock band The Who.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think he said that when he was in that band.
Okay. When did you start doing photo sessions for smash hits?
When did I? What?
So photo sessions for smash hits.
Oh, once they asked.
When did they start asking?
When did I? Pretty much from the word go, I think.
Okay.
I think.
How do you enjoy that?
It's all right. It's just, you know, it's publicity, isn't it? So you're just trying to reach. Look, I mean, you know, we're all trying to try our trade out. But if you believe in the product, then the medium that you promote it on, if you're going to reach, you know, smash hits, I would imagine their readership would not be people that were reading the NME, you know, and it's fair enough, you know. I think it's
was
quite.
Was Paul smiling because he was getting girls?
No, but
at
you,
the
you
gigs.
Think the radical nature of something like Money Go Round and the lyrics to get them printed out in smash hits, it's really, you know, it just wouldn't happen now. There wouldn't be a modern equivalent, mm-hmm. I don't think.
Live Aid, when did that come up? Was that in after My Favourite Shop?
Our favourite shop.
Our favourite shop.
You're determined to claim ownership of that. Got ambitions to run a chain of shops, maybe.
How do we enjoy Live Aid?
Well, it was certainly something unique, you know. It was something to be a bit apprehensive and scared about. I mean, it's an amazing thing, you know, like him or love him, Bob Geldof, put that together was amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were a few people that said maybe we should do this every 5 years, but it didn't come to light. But, well, I didn't think that was a bad idea either. But I don't know. We were sort of a square peg in a round hole, but, you know, we went. It's not a sort of thing you could turn down.
Charity was popular in the 80s.
What was? Charity.
Charity.
Yeah, well, you know, we were already on that sort of. We got behind a load of things before that turned up, you know what I mean? And single issue things, and we felt it was a time to stand up and be counted. And that was a very big, you know, earth-embracing world event. But there were some more domestic issues close to home that we tried to support. So it was always part of our thing. So to sort of turn that down would have seemed a bit, I don't know, mealy-mouthed or...
Okay, how do we feel about Red Wedge now, in retrospect?
I think it alienated a lot of people that liked us. I think it depended on Paul's support. I don't think it would have been quite as successful if it had just been Billy Bragg. And I think Billy Bragg said that himself. That's no slight on Billy. I'm fine with Billy. But he kind of depended on Paul's patronage in the early days of that. And I think we very nearly pulled out on the eve of its inception, because Paul said, listen, we've been doing some great things for the last 2.5-3 years before this thing's even existed. We can keep our own sort of like perspective on it. Once we went with that, it was kind of loosely affiliated with the Labour Party. You see how big boys politics is such a slow-moving beast, and it's endlessly full of compromise, and it really goes against the instincts of the way we were trying to make music and represent ourselves in the big bad world. So it was fraught with compromise, as I said. So it was an uneasy thing, and it was not that enchanting to find out what pop stars some politicians could be and what privileged little prima donnas existed.
Walls come tumbling down. Walls come tumbling down. You've got some political thread going through the lyrics, but it doesn't. When you listen to it now, it doesn't sound dated or affected by any politics in the lyrics. Which some bands can fall into that trap when they try and do political statements. Yeah. I know you did a Help the Miners thing.
Yeah.
It was a phase when I think Style Council were just thought of as a political band.
Yeah,
is it something you needed to get out of?
Well, I mean, it became a problem when we were promoting Our Favourite Shop, because that is a really good mirror of where we were at then. It's just, you know, if you look at the lyrics of that, sadly, a lot of those things are still relevant today. You wouldn't have thought it when we were doing it, but some of those things still ring true. But it's a very good reflection of what was going on in the country at the time. But it became very hard when we were promoting it to do press where anyone would talk about music. Sometimes me and Paul would do a press junket in Italy or Holland or something, where you're going back to back, you know, with like about 10 different publications or radio things. And you think, we've been here 6 or 7 hours and no one's brought up music. It's just all been politically driven questions.
Yeah. Well, let's bring up music again. Good use of the word junket, by the way.
Thank you.
So in case I get the album title wrong, A Kind of Loving?
A Kind of Loving. That's a film with Alan Bates, based on a novel.
What's the next album?
It's part of the British New Wave, which... The next album?
Yeah.
I think it was The Cost of Loving.
Cost of Loving. And the one after that.
See, I told you it was a game of two halves.
You moved into
how soon they forget.
Yeah, you moved into a more mature, grandiose production.
What the cost of loving?
Oh God, yes.
That's the orange one,
right?
We did. I think we were trying to focus on a sort of production ethic that was based on a lot of modern soul or rhythm and blues or whatever it's called then. Mm. So we were influenced by a lot of records that we might hear in clubs, and we wanted to reflect that in the way we produced the record. So that was the kind of thought behind that. I mean, in hindsight, I sort of think, I don't know if the songs were there as much, regardless of the way they were produced, but we might have put style over content there. But that's easy to see after the event. At the time, when you're engaged with any album, if you just truly believe in it, you're sort of really on board and you believe it and you think, yeah, this is the way we're going. And that was a very kind of dividing album. That's when a lot of the faithful ran away. But we were more than aware that we'd hit a peak with Our Favourite Shot, and we could have made something very similar to that and it would have gone down better.
Yeah.
But that was too easy.
So again, it's this known compromise.
Well, that was never our thing. We were just trying to move on, trying to push it somewhere else.
Mm.
And that might have cost us a bit.
King Truman, was that before modernism or after?
I think it was before.
Okay, and was that because you needed to step away from this big, large production Style Council place you were?
No, I just think it was just something we were interested in and we wanted to turn it around quickly, and it appealed to us that we might be able to do it under an alias, but the cover got blown before it got released and it all went a bit weird. But, you know, it was just something we fancied doing.
Yeah.
And it didn't need to be called the Style Council. I mean, it kind of featured Dee singing more than Paul in a way, and it was sort of more of a chant and an instrumental, and was influenced by P-Funk and sort of early street funk bands and stuff, yeah, with sax leading it. So it's just something we fancied doing, and we knew we could turn it around quickly with the early legendary label, yeah, Acid Jazz.
And then your label just said no.
No, it all got a bit nasty. The thing is, there's a bit of a revolving door at Polydor. On paper, the Style Council only existed for about 6 years, although we were sort of working on stuff for seven. In that time, we had four different managing directors, MDs. And by the time you got the hang of what one liked, the next one was along, and they all had radically different ideas. And the last one that we had just thought he was a bit of a ball breaker, and he could throw his weight around and tell us what was or wasn't a Style Council record. And it's just, by that point, we're going, look, mate, we've had three albums out. None of them are the same. We've always striven to sort of push it somewhere else. So who are you to say what is or isn't a Style Council?
So why did you make a house record?
I'm jumping a little bit ahead there, but because you've sort of leapfrogged an album between Cost of Loving and...
Well, we've only got 15 minutes left. I'm having to speed it up, this.
Okay.
And so why did you get into the garage house thing? Were you going out raving?
Well, I think we used to go to Dingle's quite a lot, and we were very big fans of Norman Jay, who was sat here a year ago under this similar scrutiny. And he used to do different nights. We used to love Shake and Finger Pop, where he played the classic, yep, funk sevens. And we also like High on Hope, where he played a lot of the more soulful end of garage and house stuff coming out of Philadelphia and New Jersey. And we really got into that. We liked the fact that the vocals seemed quite gospel-y on a lot of the tracks we like. So, and we could sort of like see a link to people like Curtis Mayfield. And it felt like current and fresh and vital and immediate. And there was, yeah, a bit of an excitement about it. And it made sense to us. I think in the early days when Acid House came out, which is a bit before that, it all seemed a bit like a lot of farty, squelchy noises.
Yes, and, it was.
If you're not on the right sort of medication, I don't know if it always made sense. But when it got more soulful and it seemed to have a bit of a sort of church gospel thing, it's as futuristic as some of it sounded, it still seemed to have the heritage of classic soul in its kind of makeup, so that drew us in, you know.
But Polydor didn't think so.
No, they didn't think so. I mean, you know, we did that cover of Promised Land, and that did it charted, did all right. So you would have thought that maybe an album somewhat in that vein might make sense. But they didn't. I think by then, relations had got sort of fraught and torn, and... You know.
So was you at this point thinking about what you were going to do next? So at the Star Council, you just thought, let's put this on the shelf for a little while, or we should deliberately stop this?
Well, I think everything happened in a bit of a rush, because we thought, Paul and I just said, you know, we're aware that people are losing patience with us a little bit. We were losing quite a lot of our core audience, but we were determined to try and do that album. And we said, this could possibly be the last album. Maybe we'd knock it on the head after that. But we thought it was going to come out. So we had hope that we'd get a couple more singles out.
Mm.
And we'd tour it in the regions that still wanted to see us live. So we're making a decision which is sort of projecting a year and a half or a year or so, saying maybe if this album doesn't really receive a fruitful sort of acceptance, then we'll knock it on the head, but let's just see this one out. But the rug was sort of pulled because they refused to release the album.
Uh-huh,
so there was nothing really to promote. And so everything got wound up maybe a year or a year and a half before, uh-huh, we expected. So,
but you started playing on Paul's solo stuff after you stopped using the name of the Star Council anyway. So it wasn't like you fell out or anything.
No, it wasn't like I fell out, and it was like a real hive of activity, our base at Solid Bond Studios. There were loads of things going at the same time. I think I was working on four albums at around the same time,
mm-hmm,
and the Style Council one's the only one that didn't see the light of day. So I was working on some stuff for Dr. Robert, who was using that studio of the Blow Monkeys.
Cool.
He was also producing DC Lee's project, which is called Slam Slam. So I was playing on that stuff. The very early demo stages of Young Disciples' first album were starting then. all of those saw the light of day. It was only our album that didn't, but it was all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So I was still in there and seeing a lot of Paul and all the staff and that. And really, after we'd split, I spent a long, long time there on Disciples stuff, Young Disciples. So there was all that going on, and you know, and that led to lots of other things. Constantine from Galliano was always down there, and he just said, "Well, if we ever get this thing with Rob off the ground, would you be part of the live band?" So I did Galliano as well.
Yes.
So that early period of Talking Loud, it was very.
What the period of Dexys you were involved with? Because
just after the Merton Parker split,
yeah.
I got asked to join Dexys about 10 days after we went our separate ways. So joined them just after Gino. I think there, my dear, come out just as I joined them.
Oh, wicked.
So that lasted for about 4 or 5 months. Then the original lineup split up, and then we formed about 5 of us out of the 8.
Yes.
Formed a band called The Bureau.
Yes. And that's with some of the Upset who supported Dexys.
Yeah, some of the Upset. Archie Brown, who had a band called The Young Bucks before the Upset. But the Upset had supported Dexys, so they were sort of known.
Yeah.
To
us. How do you find... you must have been amazing playing with the Dexys. I mean, it's so powerful.
It was good. I mean, that first... You know, I truly think that that first lineup was the most collaborative. I think after that, it started getting billed as Kevin Rowland and Dexys Midnight Runners. Uh-huh. And I think it kind of was. That first album is a real team effort, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, of course everyone knows who the captain is, but there's a lot of creatives in that whole lineup.
So was you touring with them?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was you leather jacket and a beanie hat?
I was in the Longshoreman thing, yeah. I sort of managed to go leave, you know, my point of duty by the time they become gypsies and thieves and tramps and whatever else they were. And so, yeah. But I mean, I've had 3 sort of inceptions with Dexys.
Yes.
So, but there was quite a gap. 1980, then I took a bit of a while out and come back to it in 2003.
Well, I'm very impressed with you and Dexys. So Galliano, this kind of Young Disciples... Players, you're doing a lot of these things are kind of similar-ish style.
It's a bit later, yeah. I mean, just before Players, I did a thing with Steve White called Talbot and White. And we just did an instrumental album. I think that was quite good. That was nice. And the fact that Steve had a bit of a relationship musically with Yolanda, and they had quite a good understanding. So we got that album done really quickly because they'd been doing quite a lot of touring together. Uh-huh. And they kind of... You know that thing when a bass player sort of can read a drummer and vice versa.
Yeah.
And that was very helpful. So that really fueled that album.
Bangsy.
Uh-huh.
Current, Some Over There for Sale.
Yeah. Well,
How did you record that?
Well, it was great to record that. I mean, I go back a long way with Chris. He produced the first Galliano album.
Mm-hmm.
I produced the second one. And we sort of got on and we did about 6 albums in the 90s, and then I hadn't seen him for ages, and he just fancied doing an album after a long time, and he just said, "I want to sort of reflect more 60s influences than the other stuff we did, and it'd just be a bit fun, so do you fancy it, you know?"
Well, so how did you record it? Did he do the rhythm section at home, or was it a studio
project?
Yeah,
he did a lot of rhythm tracks, and he had things that he was influenced by, and he'd just send them to me and play them, and I just play 3 or 4 takes, and he's got a real sort of creative way of editing things sometimes. So he'll seize upon your highlights, and something you played once becomes a hook, and that's that DJ end of it. Although he's a pretty good musician and an all-rounder anyway, but he's kind of got a different sort of outlook on it to the way I'd go about things. So that helps you create in a slightly different way. So, but with Chris, it's always about it's got to be fun. And he's quite scatty and frenetic, but it's very infectious to be around, you know.
I want to end, because Bolsh is going to ask some questions in the audience, or get people to ask questions. But I want to go a bit about the session musician-y thing.
Uh-huh.
Because I know you're very popular. You probably must never come off the phone.
It's not quite like that. It's like when you list it, but it's been over a long time. You know,
the ones I'm going to mention.
More busy than you are. And I want to fallow periods.
I want to read a quote. This is from Paul Weller in 1982. of Mick Talbot. He shares my hatred of the rock myth and rock culture. You played with Pete Townshend, Roger Daltrey, who I believe were a big rock band.
I've played with punk rockers. I played on Pete Stride out the Lurkers, did a solo album. Played on his album. That was good. I mean, you know, I think he's disassociating rock from rock and roll.
Oh, okay.
As long as it's swinging, I'm there.
One more thing. You live close to where I live, and we ended up in a curry house up the road, and the waiter...
Oh, what, did I dodge the bill? Did I not pay for me rice?
The accountant paid. They said, what would you like? And you said, I'll have a madras. And you gave me this kind of look like, I've just done a mod joke. A madras being a jacket
sure
similar to what you're wearing.
This is a madras. I don't think I had a madras jacket on. That. I think it was checked, but it wasn't technically the Indian cloth we know to be madras.
Okay. Well, you made me laugh. Where's Bolsh? Bolsh, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was fucking brilliant.
Thank you.
And fascinating. So, thank you. Thank you, Richard, as well. So, I'm going to open the floor up to Q&A. Julian, you can come second for this once.
Always first. I'm always constantly interested by the creative process, and you've given a really good indication of the journey of Mr. Weller and yourself through a creative process. I mean, I'm a born jazz person. I'm not in the music business like you guys, as some people might realise. But, you know, you're given a really interesting take on the movement through a creative process that you guys went through. You know, with that in mind, what are you currently artistically working on or how are you looking to move forward artistically yourself?
That's a good question. My wife often asks me that. I've done a couple of tracks for DC Lee's album, which is supposed to be coming out next year on Acid Jazz Records. It's very incestuous, I know, but I think that's very promising in prospect. And I've been working on the possible second album with Chris Bangs, which is proven to be a lot of fun. It's a bit more complicated now. He lives in Spain, but you know, we keep in touch, and that's looking quite good. And I'm always looking forward to doing something new, really. I mean, people are aware of sort of past eras and your purple patch and whatever, but if it's in your blood, you're sort of in it for the long haul, and it doesn't really mean everyone in the world has to know about what I do next, as long as it sort of satisfies me and keep the wolf from the door, you know, I'm happy, you know.
Next one, Julian Jones, here we go.
Thank you. How you doing, Mick?
I'm all right.
Could you tell everyone that earlier on we had a discussion that you were approached before the jam were to end to do the final tour? Can you tell everyone how that approach came and why you didn't do it?
Foolishly, I'm a man of my word, and I had a prior commitment. I did get asked to do the last jam tour, and in, you know, retrospect, I'm really pleased I didn't, so that there was a clean break between the jam and the Style Council. But it wasn't Paul's sort of decision. He'd already, as I said to Richard, got hold of me the end of that summer to say I'm doing something new in the new year. Then about, I don't know, a month later, he just went, we've lost our keyboard player. Can you do the final tour? And I was just about to go to Germany for a month. And we're starting rehearsals in about 3 days. He went, what is it? Is it important? I went, well, it's just my mate's band, R&B covers, just a chance to earn a bit of dough. I was on the dole at the time, so, you know, cash in hand. Don't tell anyone. But anyway, so I just said, I'm going later on today. And he went, don't you want to blow it out? This is a big thing. And I said, but it's a bit weird, isn't it? I went, are you asking me? He went, no, it's the other two remembered you from a prior session.
So
and they've asked me to... Yeah, so it wasn't even coming from Paul. But he went, I can see that's a bit might be a bit weird. I just went, listen, I've said I'm going to do something with my mate, so I'm going to stick to my word. I remember I told my dad, and he said, you're crackers, you know, turning down something like that. But, you know, I'm not that valiant, but I was then.
Yeah, your integrity stood I've you since in good learned. Stead for Weller to approach you later.
Well, I think, in hindsight, he said it made him think a lot more of me.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
now, personally and professionally, do you ever look back and think, wow, what you've done, how you've come through different genres of music, different styles from the early Parkers, right the way through the Style Council to session work?
Well, not particularly, because I always think that regardless of the genre or the style, I always think I do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, I played an album about 3 years ago, and I didn't think it's going to see the light of day. I did get paid for it. It's one of them things. A lot of things that you do work on quite often don't see the light of day. That's a fact.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen the guy that runs the studio that recorded it, and I bumped into him by chance, and he just went, Mick, that album we did for that fella called Ian, it's in the top 10 in the Irish country charts. And I said, I didn't even know it was country music.
Yeah.
You know, I just played on it as singer-songwriter's music.
Yeah.
So it's journalists or marketing people that sometimes attach genres, you know. So, but I think I always play the same thing. Yeah. They change the bass and drums and they call it a different style of music.
Yeah, yeah. Now, for the solid bond in your heart when that first came out, what do you think, how much influence of the Northern scene was that for you and Paul?
Yeah, well, it's definitely influenced by the Northern thing, yeah. You know, but not strictly Northern. And I guess before things became known as Northern, you know, the sax line's very influenced by Junior Walker. We found someone who could play a bit like that. So it's just, you know, it's just our roots and, you know. Yeah,
thank
of course,
you, Julian.
It's got an element of that.
Thank you, Julian. I'm going to go round to Mark Lesson, who wants to answer a question. Ask a question.
Thanks, Bums. Great Q&A, Mick. Really, really enjoyed it. What's been more rewarding, being in a band or doing session work?
Depends on the budget, I suppose. More rewarding in what way? I think, you know, the comradeship you build up in a band and the kind of sixth sense you get about certain people. I mean, I'm quite fortunate that when I do session stuff, and particularly if I do pick-up bands for visiting American sort of soul acts, invariably it's with the same rhythm section, which is Crispin Taylor and Ernie McCone. And they were the bedrock of the Galliano band in the early 90s, and I knew them before in the 80s when they were Push. And I like to think that we've got quite a good relationship. So in some ways, I've been knocking around with them geezers for 30 years, they just change the mug out the front, you know. So it's really nice when you feel like you've got a sixth sense about where people are going, and it can be less than a nod to know what you've got to do when things seem like they're going to hit a car crash or you need to take it to the bridge or whatever. So I think probably playing live with a band that you've got a real empathy with is more rewarding spiritually. So that's as plain as I can put it, I suppose.
Thanks for that, Mark. I've got another question from Ian here.
Afternoon, Mick.
Hi.
Ever Changing Moods. Great track. Piano version. Absolutely blew my mind and gives me goosebumps and still does. Whose idea was it to come up with that version?
The piano version?
Yeah.
Well, the piano version was sort of the first version. Sometimes these things don't always come out in the way you've recorded them. In the same way that Have You Ever Had It Blue came out after With Everything to Lose, which is the same song with different lyrics, but you don't always release them in the order that they are recorded. So it was just the piano and voice thing to start with, and then we thought we could do like a thing which we thought was a bit influenced by War, and then it began developed and it became a bit influenced by the Isleys and Curtis and became something else in the band version, you know. So it did start as just voice and piano. So that was the original, really.
Thank you, Ian. I've got Teresa Cleary here would like to ask a question.
Simple question, really, Mick. What's your proudest moment?
What's my favourite moment?
What's your proudest moment? What are you most proud of?
Proudest moment. In music?
Yes, obviously.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Getting off with that court case was quite good, but probably I don't want to. I think our Paris, just doing that, it was done really quickly, and it was a mad ramshackle 5 days in Paris, photo sessions, recording, shopping, eating, drinking, and to pack those 4 diverse tracks into that week and come out with what I thought was a good result, I think that's probably my proudest moment.
Not a bad one, I'd say. Not a bad one. Fantastic tracks.
Thank you.
So just to say thank you. Thank you so much for today. You've been brilliant.
That's all right.
Mick's going to sign some books and some records over on the table there. This and much more. So please go and queue up over there and he will say hello, take photos, whatever you need.
Okey-doke.
And but thank you so much. And just very quickly, I know people are leaving, some people are leaving this afternoon. Happy anniversary to some modcasters who met last year, Michelle Carter, Jerry Simonson. The little lovebirds, it's so lovely. Anyway, we've got loads more this afternoon, loads of DJs, till about 11 o'clock. Thank you again to Scooter guys, to all of you for being here. Lots of love for the Modcast family, thank you.
Cheers.
I go totally wired.
Back again.
I go totally, totally, totally.